So, look, thanks for hanging in there. And if any of you just struggling to get this workers' comp scene kind of clear in your mind, you know, you've got all these different arrangements and different schemes and different laws, these guys are going to help you sort it all out, right? They've got it down pat. And basically all they're going to do is affirm that you're okay because you are entitled to confusion, right? It's not a problem. Don't beat yourself up over it. So just welcome the two authors briefly. Phil Halverson there on the right is an actuary and a partner at EY. Less experienced than he looks, because he took 9 years out and grew grapes in the Hunter Valley. And not only that, he came back. And if you meet him afterwards, you can ask him why. And our other guest is Spencer McCabe, who is with CIRA, been with CIRA, the compensation regulator in New South Wales, for a fair while now, Spencer. He is a registered nurse by his original training and occupation. And he worked in the UK actually as a case manager in a sort of compensation arrangement. And now he's been a few years sort of on the police force side trying to keep control of things. So that's enough from me. These guys said to me, we do not want 30 minutes of us talking and 10 minutes for questions. So they've asked me to ask you to ask your questions as you go along. In fact, more than that, they're not questions. You can argue with them. You can make your own observations and comments. So have the discussion as we go along, not have the questions as we go along. Thanks, Ben.
Is that better?
Yeah. Okay, I think I kick off very briefly. So thanks, Jeff, and very much so. Feel free to interrupt and argue and stay awake on 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll start off by saying that this is not going to be a re-prosecution of the debate that was held yesterday afternoon. That was very well and expertly debated and voted on, and a very a good conclusion was had. And there's no judgment in this. This is just our observations. How did we get here? Well, as you're probably all aware, New South Wales has been going through some changes recently. It's always a busy jurisdiction. And so CIRA earlier this year decided to just have a little think about where we sit, where we compare to other jurisdictions, how the market structure is, how different systems work and operate. And so we reached out to our scheme actuaries to do a little bit of investigation.
Thank you, Spencer. And I think fair to say we didn't realise this was going to be as topical as it's turned out to be. So we didn't know about the debate yesterday. There's also a series of articles started in the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday. I don't know if anyone started reading that, about the sad state of federation in Australia and what it's costing us in terms of productivity, inefficiency, duplication, cost. We're passing no judgment on that, Spencer. So, Spencer came to us, asked us to have a look at this really, really interesting project. So we did a bit of desktop literature review. We actually came across a paper called Best Practice Principles in Workers' Compensation from 2015, Jeff, written by Mr. Atkins here. We cited it correctly, Jeff, don't you worry. But that was really useful. There's a lot of good papers out there that talk through the different schemes in Australia, so lots of information. And then we went and consulted with the majority of schemes, not all of them, but five or six schemes. We held really, really good interviews with some key people within those schemes and got a really good flavour of their structure, their issues, their concerns. That was really informative. And at EY, by the way, we call this partner PowerPoint. It's really, really bad. But it gets better because I only do this slide. I think we all know what's out there, but when you stack it all side by side together and you start to dig in more deeply, I think then you get a really appreciation of the confusion and the befuddlement as to how we got to where we got to. So that was a key part of this. And then through that, we started to get some insight. So look, there's myriad of differences. There's different benefit structures. There's different underwriting models. There's different dispute resolution. There's different impairment assessments and guidelines for impairment assessments. There's different support given to injured workers if they need legal support, et cetera. There's just differences everywhere you look. But where we started to get some insight is that you start to see within each scheme some really actually cool things that are working well. So, for example, some of the data analytics and monitoring that South Australia are doing seems to be really, really valuable. What Western Australia is doing with settlements and commutation is actually a pretty interesting area where they're allowing people to commute out of the scheme and get on with their life if that's in their best interests. There's a medical tribunal panel in Queensland that seems to be actually being quite effective as well. So there's little learnings everywhere, and we've tried to pull some of that together. But we are going to give you a bit of a whirlwind Workers' Comp 101 around the country. So I'll go back to Spencer.
So we'll enter workers' compensation land first. Sorry, and just to finish on that, Phil, I think one of the things that came out of the report that EY did was that despite all of these differences, not necessarily one model is better or worse than any other model, the clarity of the policy intent behind it and the execution is the thing that makes the difference. Workers' compensation land. So we've got all the states there, some of which are privately underwritten, some of which are publicly underwritten. I think the interesting thing about this slide is for each jurisdiction, there's a whole new system in place. And that's true even for the smaller jurisdictions. So ACT and Northern Territory, which have around about 100,000 workers, each have their own systems. And I think that goes to some of the debate yesterday around the efficiency across the whole of the country. Slightly different in CTP, Phil?
Yeah, we'll go to that. Spencer did ask us to look pretty broadly internationally, which we did, and we just picked out California because it's a really interesting model over there. There's a big, large government insurer operating side by side with private insurers in a quite a successful scheme covering 18 million employees.
It could be really good. Could be like the UK, which has about, 30,000 employees, one set of legislation, one system.
CTP, it's a bit hard to tell, but it feels a bit like the mirror opposite of the slide before. So let's have another look at that.
Yeah, side by side, they are inverse. Where the CTP is publicly underwritten, the workers' comp is privately underwritten, and the reverse is true. And I think, really, to me, this just shows how the different states and the different schemes within the different states have pretty much organically grown and adapted to whatever circumstances needed to be adapted to at the time, be that, New South Wales is changing at the moment, or potentially changing at the moment. Different political persuasions as these schemes develop. Quite confusing, really.
Yeah, quite confusing again. Yes.
You add to that the complexity. So you might just skip through this just because in the interests of time. But there are so many stakeholders within each of these systems. From a workers' compensation perspective, you've got the employer and the worker who is the centre stage, the reason that the system exists. But around that, you've got the insurers and various insurer types and models that the insurers operate underneath. Within the insurers, you've got how they manage their claims. Some have in-house claims management. Some have external claim service providers. Beyond the claim service providers and the claim setup, you've got the support mechanisms that are around that dictate dispute resolution. So I'll just talk to New South Wales because that's what I know best. But in New South Wales, you know, if you've got a complaint, depending on what the complaint is, you can come to CIRA or you can go to the Independent Review Office. If you've got a dispute, you can get ILARS funding from the Independent Review Office, but then you have to go to the Personal Injury Commission. It's really quite complex, and how individuals navigate this system is probably the fact that they can at all is quite impressive. And then beyond that, you've got the broader service providers that sit within the various systems by way of, you know, medical intervention, legal services, rehab services, so on and so forth. And then finally, sitting across the top, you've got the regulator. Don't forget the regulator. And all of this is replicated across each jurisdiction. Not only that, adding to the complexity is it's a different set of rules for each jurisdiction, different set of backbone legislation that supports each jurisdiction. So again, I'll talk to New South Wales. In New South Wales, we have the 1987 Act, we have the 1998 Act, we have the 2016 regulation, we have all the guidelines and the guidance materials that we operate within. And again, all of that is replicated all around the country.
All right. So very quickly, we'll just run through some differences in benefits. So these are weekly benefits. So just across these five jurisdictions, we've got all these step downs by duration, and you've got maximum durations that you can be receiving weekly benefits, some based on weeks, some based on a dollar maximum. There really should be asterisks all through this page because there's caveats and exceptions everywhere through this. My PowerPoint wasn't up to putting all those on. Then it gets really interesting when we talk about access to lump sums and common law within these schemes. And we've heard a little bit about this the last couple of days. And if anyone's been watching, as Spencer and I do, parliamentary committees, because we're very exciting people in New South Wales, this has been a heavy topic of conversation. So New South Wales, 15% is a key threshold for psychological injuries. That's assessed by the PEERS scale. Victoria, that threshold is 30%, but that's assessed by the JEPIC scale, which may or may not be equivalent and give you a different answer. And so on it goes. There is no consistency here whatsoever. This is the one probably really does my head in. What's a death worth? Well, that depends where you live, basically. So you can see just, I'm not going to dwell on it, but these benefits are totally inconsistent across the country. Maybe I'll just move on. And the last one, the lump sum permanent impairment scales, completely different in each jurisdiction. Okay, so appreciate I've rushed through that, but we're going to try to bring it to life a little bit. So we've got a hold of a couple of real-life claims, and we've mapped the life of those claims, and we've had a look at what the outcome, the financial outcomes would be within each jurisdiction. And then we've done a little bit of, what should we call it?
Correction.
Correction about what a pathway might have looked like for some of these claims if timely decisions had been made in a timely manner for the benefit of the injured worker. So, first one, Spencer.
Well, I'm interested. Nobody's disagreed with us yet. Nobody's arguing. So I like the fact that we did this because when I come to a conference like this, we have a lot of stats and a lot of high-level data analysis. And what we did here is we actually delved down into the detail and got granular and got specific data around specific people. These are people that are within our workers' compensation system in New South Wales. And I think the advantage of doing that is to see if we can see if this tells us anything that we can then translate back at that more macro level. That might be a bit of a hint about a question we might be asking you towards the end of this. So just to get us started, this is a fairly simple example of an injury. Within New South Wales, you've got a 50 to 55-year-old male manufacturing worker. It's got a laceration. And we picked this one because this is not an insignificant injury. This worker required surgery on the day of the injury, and ultimately ended up with a WPI of 5%. So this is not a nothing claim. And what we see in the data here is actually the notification to the insurer in the first instance, very important, happened very early on in the day. And what that means, obviously, is the insurer can get on board and do the injury management and return to work management for the worker. The insurer accepted provisional liability pretty quickly, enabled the associated benefits, the support through weekly payments and the support through medical intervention, moved to a full acceptance of liability, continued with that that support in the recovery, and then introduced workplace rehab at an appropriate time for this this case. So you can see the result of that, you've got a sort of not working, no capacity period of time whilst the worker's recovering from the acute phase of the injury. You've then got a suitable employment opportunity that's exercised because of that workplace rehab support. And then you've eventually got a full return to work. It's quite a nice example of how the system can work well. What does that cost, Phil?
Okay. So under each scheme, this is roughly what that claim would cost. And there is not much disparity between the different jurisdictions. So if you go back to that slide we had with the weekly benefits and how it changes between jurisdictions, on this claim, as Spencer said, where it was managed well and the injured worker was able to get back to work, the blue bars, which are the weeklies and the medicals, are relatively consistent. There's some small lump sum differences in some of the jurisdictions, but not material in this particular case.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Which colour is the weekly comp?
The bottom one's weekly comp.
Disappeared off the scale.
Ah, yes. Sorry about that. Yes. All right.
Okay, so on to our second case study, which is a little bit more complex and maybe not as straightforwardly handled. So I've got a lot of empathy for this particular case study. It's a 50 to 55-year-old nurse. I might happen to fit into that demographic myself. Male, not female in this case. So this is a nurse. She's working in a clinical environment, and she's got a traumatic injury to a joint. I'm guessing it's either a hip or a knee injury. Again, you've got the accident date. She ceased working. She went through an acute period of recovery. The injury was notified to the insurer. The insurer chose to accept provisional liability in a relatively short period of time, which was good. And again, that enables the benefits and the support and the injury management to happen for that worker. You've then got a period of rehab. So probably up until right about here, this case is going pretty well. Thank you, Phil. And then for reasons that are not essentially clear, you've got a disputation of liability, which is a bad thing in terms of this timeline. It's not necessarily always a bad thing. Obviously, insurers can dispute liability for claims. But for the consequence to this liability, it was the wrong decision. Ultimately, a later decision was made where liability was accepted. The later decision is the preferable decision. So I would argue that denial of liability was the wrong decision to make at that point in time. And what it did is you've got this period here between denial and then acceptance of liability. And that's between sort of 6 months and 2 years. And there is no support being provided to this worker during that period of time. There's no rehab. There's no weekly payments. There's no medical support. Once liability is accepted, then all those payments get reimbursed retrospectively, but that really doesn't help at the time. Further support was provided. Ultimately, an IME was conducted and a Section 66 lump sum payment was made to this worker. I think the real killer thing for me on this example is you've got this period of no working whilst you've got an acute recovery of the injury. But the worker actually returns to work in the same employment for a period of time whilst that support's being given. When the claim gets disputed, you've then got a period of not working. It varied between the worker having capacity, not having capacity, working a little bit, trying to get back to work, then not working again. And this this sort of limbo period where the worker was kind of left to her own devices to self-manage and do whatever she could, which ultimately has not worked out well for her. So she continues, and the latest capacity coding on the claim is that she's got no work capacity. She's not working. This claim is still open. She's been assessed at 16% WPI. I'd argue it's very likely that this will consequently become a work injury damages claim and have a quite a large lump sum attachment to it. So what does that cost us, Phil?
Okay. So now we have an expensive claim, and we're starting to see some disparity between the different jurisdictions. So we're sitting on about $500,000, but as Spencer said, probably looking at another $300,000 to $400,000 in work injury damages. So less in Victoria, where there's now a weekly benefit cutoff, and then some differences in the lump sums that's already been awarded through each jurisdiction. However, we did a bit of navel gazing.
We did, and this may be a little optimistic, but it's possible, and my experience in claims management tells me this, it's possible to change the trajectory of a claim if you intervene early and you intervene well. So an alternate pathway for this claim could have been, again, you've got the initial aspects are exactly the same, you've got the injury, you've got your first service of treatment, and you've got the notification to the insurer. But the insurer in this instance accepts liability in full, doesn't go to provisional and then full, just accepts liability, and then introduces that support for the worker in a consistent and maintaining way. I think the key to this is, you know, you can't just say, oh, well, just do workplace rehab and everything will be fine, because that's, you know, life's not as simple as that. But this is an educated worker that has a skill set that is either maintainable through you've got an injury to your knee or your hip or whatever it is. You can do things to actually manage that and maintain your employment, or you can do things to actually find alternative appropriate employment for this individual. Again, I'm a nurse between 50 and 55. I can probably turn my hand to a few different things. So I don't think that that's unachievable at all. And the consequence is you get a much cleaner claim. We're still including the 16% permanent impairment, and we're still including the lump sum that's associated with that. I think there's an argument that you could present that say that's less likely to happen. Certainly less likely to happen is a work injury damages claim. And even if the work injury damages claim does follow through, because you've got this engagement in work, you don't have the same economic loss, so you don't have the same size of claim. So in this rather nicer example, Phil.
So that was the original claim, what it's looking like costing. And under Spencer's scenario, that's what the costs could turn out to be if some of those decisions were made in a more timely manner. Okay. Should we do one more?
We'll do one more. Fairly quickly.
Briefly.
We'll do it quickly, yep. So we've got a third and final example here. This is a much younger worker, female under the age of 30, working in a dentistry, was the victim of workplace harassment and bullying. So had a sort of an incident date, some early sort of lack of input, really. The notification to the insurer doesn't happen until sort of probably the three-month mark. And what the insurer first and foremost does is it applies a reasonable excuse to that claim. And what that does in New South Wales is basically the insurer saying, you know, you haven't given us enough probably medical evidence in this instance. And interestingly and probably significantly, the insurer also instigates an investigation. So on one hand, it's pushing the worker away, whilst at the other, because it's saying, well, you haven't really given us enough information to make a claim, whilst at the other saying, well, actually, we think we've got enough information to make a claim, so we're going to investigate it. So that's not a great experience for the worker concerned. They then move to provisional acceptance of liability, but that's at about the four-month stage. 4 months is a long time for a worker to be without support. The investigation obviously comes through. There's an IME, and ultimately they accept full liability at about the five-month stage. So again, that's a long time to go for the worker to not be sort of properly in the system. So arguably you've lost a lot of ground already. From that point in time, there was workplace rehab provider allocated the claim, which is probably an appropriate thing to do. But interestingly, from the coding on the payments, we can see that the workplace rehab was geared towards returning the worker back to their prior employment at their prior employer. And you're talking about a small dental practice here. There's not a lot of movement and opportunity to kind of address some of those. So whilst that in the early days might be a reasonable thing to be striving to achieve, it never seemed to get away from there. So again, the work has gone through periods of capacity, periods of not capacity, but not being able to return to work without the focus of that rehab shifting into, well, maybe we should be thinking about something else. Again, you've got, you know, a female less than 30 years old. This is, you know, young contributor to the New South Wales society and economy, which ultimately then, again, has a WPI, again, of 16%, a consequential lump sum payment, and then a common law settlement at the end. Phil?
So we really start to see some differences now when it comes to psychological injuries. So New South Wales, Queensland, you're looking at a $600,000 financial impact. In Victoria, which changed its legislation about 12 months ago, cut out lump sums for psychological injury, and South Australia similarly. So you're really seeing now some inequity of how this person would have been treated in the different jurisdictions.
Again, our alternate time path, pathway, is earlier intervention, more positive, sooner decision-making, better quality injury management and intervention. So you've got an earlier provisional acceptance of liability, and use of provisional liability is perfectly legitimate. I don't have an issue with it at all. For a case like this, it allows the insurer to go through a process of investigation and actually fully determine whether there's liability or not. That's fine. That's New South Wales legislation. But in the meantime, it utilises the mechanism of the legislation to actually provide support for that worker whilst it's ongoing. You have your investigation, you accept your liability. I'd argue that the rehab intervention could have been better in this case and more productive. So you would go through a period of not working, a period of alternative job seeking and placement, and then ultimately, hopefully, a full return to work and return to capacity. Much better outcome for the individual concerned. At the end of this timeline, I'm guessing that this person would be much happier, healthier, contributive, feelings of self-worth. So the outcome for the individual, I would argue, is much better.
The original pathway and the alternate pathway. So one of the takeaways Spencer and I came to on this, to Spencer's point that it's a better outcome for the worker. Financially, it's taking care of itself as well, because we're getting a better financial outcome for the scheme at the same time. Yeah. All right. Is there any questions so far? Any disagreements with what we're saying to Jeff's rev up at the start?
There's nothing on my little screen, so I don't want you to shout.
Because otherwise we're going to ask you questions. Yeah. So.
I think we should do that.
One addition to that analysis could be the modelling of what a CSP might receive, I guess, in compensation for each of those labels.
I think the way that particularly CSPs, and regardless of the jurisdiction, are incentivated and remunerated, I think is absolutely key. You're totally on the ball. Yeah.
Any others?
Spencer, you had a comment, cheeky comment before, which is these differences seem to be driven by the policy intent or execution. So, yeah, can you give us some examples where maybe the policy intent or philosophy, you know, like the cost of the debt, why is that different? Cost of mistakes and cost of living? what is it?
I think that's a... That's a really good question. And in the most part, I probably can't answer it because I've not been in the room at the time the policy decisions have been made. I know that sort of the death benefit in New South Wales, for example, was looked at relatively recently and adjusted to reflect the I don't want to say the value that's put on it because that's entirely wrong. But the appropriate level of compensation that the New South Wales Parliament thinks is appropriate for that set of circumstances. So a lot of the policy, whilst it might be informed by various stakeholders, hopefully quite significantly by the regulator, ultimately it's the will of the various parliaments usually that do things like, you know, the actual value of something like a death lump sum settlement.
I think sorry.
Why did you leave off
Comcare? Only because we didn't consult with Comcare for the piece of work we did. That was the main piece. And sorry, your question probably goes to our first sort of thought starter, which was, and I'm a little bit idealistic, but I'm not idealistic enough to think we're going to end up with harmonised set of benefits across the country. But should we have a set of minimum standards, to your point around death benefits, that each scheme should have to abide by?
Should abide by them.
Richard?
So, this is not my area, but would you have national WHS exception?
I think that's right.
Yeah. 12 years. Victoria is not a dog.
Right.
And we do have things like heads of workers' compensation where all the jurisdictions come together and meet and collaborate and share ideas. So it's not unheard of, but to the extent that you're suggesting there, Phil, I think comes back down to some of the fundamental drivers of the schemes and where each scheme might be at any given point in time. So affordability, for example, you know, you're not going to be increasing benefits and entitlements to workers when the scheme can't afford it. So it's very much, I think, piece in time for each jurisdiction.
I think, sorry, yes.
In the second scenario, they kind of got one up track when the insurance feared liability. So, and you can see in the scenario, it's a better outcome for everything, not just
avoid disputing liability?
Yeah, well, that's what it's about.
I'd argue that in that, no, I don't think it's better, because I can't think it's better, because I have to operate within the legislative construct that New South Wales presents, so I'll put it in a New South Wales context. So I'm not going to say, no, ignore the law. I'm never going to say that. but what I would say is, Mr. Insurer, before you make that decision, be very careful and be very cognizant about the consequences of that decision, because it can come back and financially it can bite you in a very big way. And, you know, it's almost creating two arguments. One argument that says, well, you should do the right thing because your heart tells you to do the right thing. And the other argument is, well, you should do the right thing because it's your head should tell you that it's doing the right thing. And so if you can maybe predict some of these outcomes and say, well, if you're going to do this, then this is going to be the down the road consequence, then it'll give you both a heart and a head reason not to. And I guess that's my question to probably the actuaries in the audience. How do we better use our data to make sure that we are informing practice in a real world way? We have lots and lots of data. Yeah, okay. We're sort of swimming in it.
Can I just add to what Spencer's saying is that we took a random sample of 10 claims and we found those two. And there's probably another two we could have done something very similar with. It's not hard to find them. So I'm an actuary, but my challenge to my profession is we have to use this data better than what we are using it at the moment. These schemes are rich in data. And this was structured data. We're not even talking getting to the unstructured data, which Min spoke about yesterday, where AI might give us some really good solutions to look even deeper into the data. This was on the file, on the claim header and payment transaction files.
We're working in collaboration with experts, not actuaries and...
Correct.
Regulator, claims managers, whatever.
Yeah.
Sure.
Tough question. Thank you. Third case, right? Young woman. If she was in Queensland, you showed both a common law and a lump sum. And this questioner suspects that being below 20%, that worker would need to choose one or the other, and not both.
That is correct. We didn't want anyone to fact check our work live on stage. But that is correct.
Who put that question in?
Yes, well spotted. That was a test. any other questions, comments? We had one more, so yeah, let's do that. So we had help with this from Spencer and from Carl Ackerman at CIRA that have experience as case managers. And we didn't invent those alternate pathways. We didn't think, let's come up with the best possible thing to make the numbers look good. These guys actually thought this is feasible. So what's for the case managers, the people that are working in schemes out there, what's stopping us from making better decisions at in a more timely manner?
Can't predict how an individual person will respond.
Yeah, absolutely. So CIRA did a review of case management recently, and we found that case management in New South Wales, there were sort of improvements that could be made. And one of the significant recommendations coming out of the report, you can read it on our website, is around adopting a person-centred approach and actually looking at the person, putting it in the middle of the consideration. And that doesn't mean giving the person whatever the person wants. That's not a person-centred approach at all. It's about looking at the person and the influencing factors that are affecting that person, be it medical, psychological, the insurance domain, workplace domain, and actually risk assessing that and coming up with a plan to address those risks as they're identified and executing against the plan in order to get the right outcome for that individual worker. I think there's a skill in there that certainly, as I see it, probably across Australia, we could all improve on.
All right. Yes.
Did you work still on the or is there a way to kind of
that's a good question. The work is finished.
It's not public.
It's not public. maybe there is a sanitized version we could think about. There is lots of just factual information.
Yeah. It's mostly factual.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly the bits of the French positive the room. It's fascinating.
Yeah, good. Yeah, thank you. Good question. Yeah.
It was more sort of general. It wasn't, attached specifically to any one thing. It's just about informing us more broadly and just seeing where we sit and how we operate in comparison to the other states and territories and even internationally.
Well, thank you to Spencer and Philip and Natasha.
Yes,
thank you for that.
Yes, definitely.